Welcome to the 15th Annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. I'm Eugene Meyer, President of the Society, and this memorial lecture started, as many of you know, shortly after 9/11. Ted Olson's inaugural lecture reminded us of what it means to be an American, how our legal tradition is a critical part of our identity as Americans. Both Ted, who is here today, and Barbara understood this connection. We want this lecture to remind lawyers of it, so they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. Other lecturers have included Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Vice President Cheney, Judges Ken Starr, Robert Bork, Ray Randolph, Edith Jones, Douglas Ginsburg, Dennis Jacobs, then Judge, now Justice Neil Gorsuch, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, Peter Thiel, John Allison, and Senators Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse. That brings us to today's lecture. It's my honor to introduce for this year's lecture, Barbara Olson, for this year's Barbara Olson lecture, White House Counsel Don McGahn. Before the counsel's office, Don served as chairman of the FEC and more recently was a partner at Jones Day, and before that at Patton Boggs, all that prior to joining the Trump campaign as their counsel. He earned his BA from Notre Dame and his JD from Widener. Don has in common with Barbara Olson an entrepreneurial spirit that he has brought to everything he does. And like Barbara, he has made his own way, often raising and approaching questions in an unconventional way and advocating things simply because he thought they were right. One of his major interests has been judges. Another is the administrative state, about which, as this conference shows, and as we heard last night, there is increasing discussion and debate. It is typical that Don, like Barbara, takes the lead in such critical discussions and battles. It is also typical that he does it with energy, zest, and good humor. In his work on both judges and administrative law, Don is committed to the Constitution and its structure, and committed through his public service to advancing the form of government that, to put it in his boss's words, makes America great. I am delighted to welcome Don McGahn as the 2017 Barbara Olson Lecturer.
Thank you very much. I think I'm just going to quit while I'm ahead. Thank you. The reception will be across the hall. It's really an honor to be here, to be invited to the Barbara Olson lecture. I knew Barbara. I believe I actually met her at this hotel during a Federalist Society convention like this one many, many years ago. And when Leonard called and asked if I could do this lecture, I think I said, I think you dialed the wrong number. Because then I looked it up, and Gene, first, thanks for the kind introduction, but two, he listed all the folks who have given this lecture over the years, and when you hear names like Bork and Scalia and Randolph and Roberts and Gorsuch, and then me, one of those names really is different than the rest. I'll just give a hint. I don't have any problem with truck drivers. People in the media are wondering what that was about. The Federalist Society is really an amazing organization. I've been privileged to be a part of it for many, many years and watch it grow. I remember the first time that I attended one of these conferences. It was 1995. I had recently moved to Washington, D.C., and I didn't really know anyone, and very few people would talk to me. Now I know a lot of people, and very few people still actually want to talk to me. I met a number of people over the years. I remember meeting someone else who had just moved to D.C., and the conversation went like this. You just moved to D.C., yes. So what were you doing before? I was a law clerk. This is the person I met. And who'd you clerk for? Oh, Alito. I said, okay, Third Circuit. Where'd you go to school? Harvard. Undergrad or law? Both. I said, oh, this was Alex Acosta, and and now he's Secretary of Labor. So for the young lawyers out there, you never know who you're going to meet. Keep in touch. Someday the person you're talking to may be White House counsel, and the president may be looking for a Secretary of Labor. You just never know. And I haven't got. I haven't even gotten to the funny parts yet. The other thing I remember, and this is the first conference, again, sort of the lesson, you never know who you're going to meet. I didn't know anyone, and I managed to stumble into the banquet dinner, sort of the predecessor of what we had last night. And I recall when it was across the hall in just one of the ballrooms, and there was plenty of room between the tables to navigate. The society was not as large as it is now. And I was looking around, and I finally heard someone say, hey, here, there's an empty chair with us. And someone grabbed me by the coat, and I sat down, and I looked, and this person said, hi, I'm Ken Cribb. And I said, oh, wait, you're one of these, the guy from the Reagan administration? And this wasn't, you know, too long after the Reagan. He said, yes. Yeah. So we were around the table. I thought, this is great. We go around and introduce that. I was at the Federalist Society Illuminati table, and we get around, and across the someone stands up, says, hi, I'm Ed Meese. And I thought, you look just like Ed Meese. So I was so excited. I went home, and I was only in D.C. for maybe 2 weeks. And I called my mom at 11 o'clock at night, and she was afraid I was in jail. But then she realized I wouldn't be able to actually make the call. So I told her all about it, and I thought that every weekend in Washington, D.C. was going to be just like that. It was not even close. But here we are. The past several years for me have been a very interesting journey. It's been a privilege to be part of a presidential campaign that was successful and to have the honor of being named counsel to the President of the United States. It all began in Iowa, as most things do in presidential campaigns, and the memory I have of Iowa was standing in my hotel room in Des Moines, looking out the window at the iconic Des Moines skyline, and we had, if you do enough campaigns, it's iconic. And I remember I traded voice messages with someone from the Federalist Society who will remain nameless so I don't embarrass Jonathan Bunch. And we finally connected on the phone, and I had heard that they were attempting to figure out how to get in touch with the Trump campaign. They had managed to get in touch with all the other campaigns, but the Trump campaign, you may recall, was kind of lean and mean. And, it caught on with the voters quite quickly, but did not really catch on with the political class. Frankly, still hasn't, and we're very proud of that. It's funny now, but were you laughing then? I was. I get John, and I have substance coming up, but hang on, just keep going, okay. Get on the phone with the unnamed Federalist Society person with the initials JB, and he said, hey, you know, I want to talk to you. We're trying to get in touch with the Trump campaign. We're reaching out, talk about, you know, campaigns want to talk about judicial selection. Obviously, we're not going to take positions in the elections. You know, I said, I understand that. I dabble in nonprofit tax law from time to time. Side note, Lois Lerner was the head of FEC enforcement years ago, just saying. So I said, oh, I'm glad you called. We were just talking about judicial selection. Oh, and the voice on the other end of the phone said, oh, you were? I said, yeah, we actually have somebody in the campaign that's going to help us. And there was a pause. Oh, who? Very excitedly, who is it? I said, oh, former chief of staff to President Bush, John Sununu. He has a lot of experience. So there is this just deafening pause on the other end of the phone. And being in Des Moines, I thought maybe the phones went down, even though it was my cell phone. So I hear on the other side this sort of throaty kind of, well, it's good that you have someone helping. I said, yeah, it's going to be great. He has experience and, you know, a proven record, and we asked him to come up with a couple different lists. And the first list We want mainstream folks, not a big paper trail, and, you know, the kind of folks that, you know, will get through the Senate and, you know, will make us feel good that we've put some pragmatic folks on the bench. So the voice on the other end of the lines, you know, I could just hear this sort of gasp. And so I said, we're going to have a second list. And the second list, we've asked them to put together some folks, you know, kind of too hot for prime time, you know, the kind that'd be really hot in the Senate. Probably people have written a lot. We really get a sense of their views. And we want to make sure, you know, we you know, the kind of people, you understand, the kind of people that, you know, make some people nervous. And he said, oh, okay, well, well, what are you going to do with each list? I said, well, the first list we're going to throw in the trash, and the second list, that is what we're going to put before the U.S. Senate, because I know Leader McConnell is going to get it done. So, I'm just going to forget my canned remarks and keep going. So there was this pause, and I did not know Jonathan Bunch then, like I know him now. And he, you know, he kind of stammered and wasn't particularly sure. And he said, wait, what did you just say? And I said, you heard me. And he said, oh. And I said, look, you have nothing to worry about. You know, I've known Leonard for years. I've been in the Federalist Society. You have nothing to worry about. Well, seriously, we're already thinking about it. And, you know, I kind of rattled off a couple names of people for different circuits. And he said, oh, whew, okay. I could just imagine when he called Leonard after the call to report back. So that began quite a journey that led to Mr. Trump, now President Trump, putting out a list of potential Supreme Court folks, never really have been done before. In typical fashion, it was not done in the primary season to head fake people to thinking he was more conservative than he was. It came out after he was the presumptive nominee for the general election, at which point every consultant in Washington, D.C. said, as they said once a week, oh, it's over. Can't do that, got to move to the middle. Especially in that judge thing, going to scare people. So it really kind of tells you where we are with that piece. And you know, it's really I'm very fortunate to serve a president who is very committed to what we are committed to here, which is nominating and appointing judges that are committed originalists and textualists. And. And I think I can safely say it's not just talk. If you look at who's been nominated, who's already gotten through the Senate, I think he's made good on what he said. And for all the chattering class of D.C. who thought it was a head fake or it was just made up or it was going to be something different, I think this, among other things, we've proven them time and time, proven that wrong time and time again. So let me turn to the boring part. Which is regulation and the rule of law in the administrative state. And then I'll end with more jokes at the end. My remarks tonight rest on two independent but related ideas. The greatest threat to the rule of law in our modern society is the ever-expanding regulatory state. And the most effective bulwark against that threat is a strong judiciary. In some ways, executive agencies are as old as the Republic. The State Department, the Treasury Department, and the Department of War were created shortly after the founding. So the idea that there are agencies within the executive branch is something that has been around a long, long, long time. It was always understood that the executive branch would have these departments. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution expressly contemplates them, talks in terms of executive departments led by principal officers from whom the president may require an opinion in writing on relevant matters. But the edifice of the modern administrative state was really not constructed until the 20th century on the misguided notion that independent experts, rather than our elected representatives, are best suited to govern the nation's affairs. Woodrow Wilson was the most notable avatar of this approach, where he argued for a separation of politics from the work of governing, leaving the big decisions to the supposedly above-the-fray nonpartisan experts. Taken to its logical conclusion, one wonders why we should continue to have elections at all. Under that way of thinking. Since then, the administrative state has expanded beyond anyone's wildest imagination. To give you just one example, in 1960, the Code of Federal Regulations was just over 20,000 pages. Today, it totals over 200,000 pages. The pervasiveness of federal regulation is unavoidable. There are scores of agencies and armies of bureaucrats that claim to be so-called independent of any presidential control. They proudly claim to be nonpartisan, but a review of their political giving history and voter registration and the like says otherwise. They derisively call presidential appointees politicals while wrapping themselves in the faux nobility of being careers, a career which too often is cloistered within the confines of their own regulatory structure. It is virtually impossible for any individual or business to know, let alone ensure compliance with, each of the regulatory commands that these agencies and bureaucrats produce. But where does the authority for this vast administrative state come from? Let's start where we should always start, the Constitution. The Constitution very clearly vests all government power in three branches of government. Article 1, as we all know in this room, provides that all legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Article 2, this is the lecture part. Article 2 states that the executive power shall be vested in a President of the United States. We particularly like that one. Article 3 says that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. How does the modern administrative leviathan fit within this system? Many in this room say it does not. But the problem is not merely a formalistic constitutional objection. The ever-growing, unaccountable administrative state is a direct threat to individual liberty. It is well documented that the previous administration had one of the worst records before the Supreme Court in American history. Several losses were before a unanimous court. In many cases, that is because its agencies were far exceeding their statutory and constitutional authority, and in doing so, were directly intruding on individual rights. Just look at some of the most important cases the Supreme Court decided in recent years. Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, Little Sisters of the Poor. Those arose out of administrative action. They were not in the statute. Instead, the Department of Health and Human Services imposed a contraceptive mandate through regulation. In Horn versus Department of Agriculture, the court rejected the Agriculture's Department requirement that raisin farmers set aside large amounts of their crops for government use without just compensation. At oral argument, the government's attorney insisted that this uncompensated confiscation of raisins was just, quote, standard regulation, unquote. The Supreme Court, fortunately, disagreed. Now we can all have raisins. In Michigan versus EPA, the court invalidated an environmental regulation that imposed nearly $10 billion in costs per year for only $6 million of benefits. And Ozana Tabor versus EEOC, the EEOC sued a church for terminating a minister that, in the church's view, had violated a tenet of their faith. The Supreme Court unanimously disagreed. These are only a few examples, but they demonstrate how severe the threat is and how the courts are an essential check on the expansion of administrative power. None of this is news to people in this room, except maybe the media. Hello. From its inception, there's a reason why President Trump asked me to be his lawyer. From its inception, the Federalist Society has emphasized the importance of separation of powers, of individual liberty, and that the role of the courts is to say what the law is, not what the law should be. Federalist Society members span a wide spectrum of political philosophies and policy preferences. What we share is a commitment to the rule of law, to the same enduring truths that infuse the brilliant design of our founding charter, that due process matters, that the structure of our government matters, and that the meaning of words means something, and that an erosion of those principles is a direct threat to individual liberty. That is why regulatory reform and judicial selection are so deeply connected. In my view, they are the two greatest legal issues that this administration will address. The president is making fundamental changes to how the regulatory state interacts with the people, and he is selecting judges who will enforce the laws written and respect the separation of powers. The Trump vision of regulatory reform can be summed up in three simple principles: due process, fair notice, and individual liberty. The Trump vision of the judiciary can be summed up in two words: originalism and textualism. Tonight, I hope to unpack these ideas and provide some insight in how the administration is working to advance these principles. Let's begin with the administrative state. A few years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called Sackett versus EPA. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it. You're familiar with the case and the Kafka-like regulatory process that the EPA inflicted on the Sackett family. For those not sure, let me recap the facts. But this case, before I do that, captures the disturbing clarity of the many problems of the modern administrative state. The Sacketts purchased land near Priest Lake, Idaho, and planned to build a home on it. But as they were preparing the land for construction, the EPA sent them a so-called compliance order, claiming that the Sacketts' construction was prohibited because their land was covered by the Clean Water Act. Even though it was several lots away from any body of water, the EPA asserted that the land qualified as navigable waters under the Act, and thus the Sacketts could not fill the land as necessary to build their home. The agency ordered the Sacketts to undo the construction they had begun and restore the land to an EPA-approved condition or face up to $75,000 a day in fines. Here's the kicker. The EPA denied the Sacketts an administrative hearing and then argued that the Sacketts lacked any right to challenge the EPA's actions in court. It seemed Woodrow Wilson's dream of the so-called experts being free of any influence or interference, even judicial review, had come true. The case made its way to the Supreme Court on that last question, whether the Sacketts had any right to challenge the EPA's actions in court, and the Supreme Court unanimously held that they did. To a group of lawyers, this should seem like a pretty straightforward proposition. A government agency sought to enjoin private individuals from using their personal property and imposed a crushing fine if they failed to comply. As Justice Alito noted in his concurrence, in a nation that values due process, not to mention private property, such treatment is unthinkable. But to the agency, this was just standard regulation. The EPA's authority cannot be questioned, so they said. But the issue is not isolated to the EPA. It infects all agencies, big and small. I had my own encounter with this during my tenure at the Federal Election Commission. It was clear that due process was a foreign concept, and I was quite vocal about that. The Commission's business was being conducted in secret, in some instances, on an ad hoc basis in others, and the agency really lacked publicly available procedures that govern both the Commission and its staff. The idea of ensuring that those accused of wrongdoing had a meaningful opportunity to be heard by the Commission was anathema to many. To make matters worse, some staff at the FEC viewed themselves as independent of the commissioners appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate to run the agency. According to these folks, they had authority to make decisions devoid of any statutory, let alone constitutional authority. Think about that for a moment. The FEC's status as an independent agency, as part of what some call the fourth branch, is already troubling under Article 2 of the Constitution, and the Supreme Court had already held that the original structure of the FEC was unconstitutional in Buckley versus Vallejo. But the staff's view that it was somehow insulated from and was under no obligation to take direction from, the Commission itself was really a bridge too far. In their mind, they were a fifth branch of the government, independent from the independent agency and accountable to absolutely no one who had been elected by the citizens they sought to regulate. This is not isolated, but seems to be business as usual in the administrative state. Take, for example, the case of Free Enterprise Fund versus Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. There, the Supreme Court held that the PCAOB original appointment structure was unconstitutional because its members could be removed only for cause by SEC commissioners, who were themselves removable by the President only for cause. Judge Kavanaugh's opinion in the D.C. Circuit seized on this double for cause removal protection as a violation of separation of powers, and the Supreme Court agreed with him, reversing the D.C. Circuit. These are the problems I tried to uproot at the FEC, and they are the problems the current administration is facing across the government. Agencies have an obligation to afford regulated parties due process, including an opportunity to be heard. Agencies must be accountable to the elected head of the executive branch, and the courts should view agencies' claims of sweeping authority with skepticism, not nonchalance. In the first step in preserving individual liberty in the face of the burgeoning federal leviathan is to insist on fair notice. The government has an obligation to clearly inform parties of the rules that will apply to them. Anyone who has engaged with the regulatory state in the last several decades knows that agencies have often taken precisely the opposite approach. Far too often, agencies issue vague regulations, or in some cases, no regulations at all. Then they interpret those vague regulations through Byzantine interpretive rules, guidance documents, or so-called dear colleague letters. To administrative law experts, these are known by the Orwellian term sub-regulatory actions. But whatever you call them, they're illegitimate. Typically, they receive no public comment, and often they come with no advance warning before the agency suddenly springs them on unwitting parties to enforcement actions or ominous warning letters. And agencies have often managed to duck judicial review of sub-regulatory actions, claiming they are not final binding rules. But they are inconsistent with the rule of law. There There is no way for regular people and small businesses to keep up with the constant flood of regulatory and sub-regulatory actions that pour out of the ever-expanding regulatory state. This nonstop spigot is a fair notice problem in its own right. Even when agencies announce what the rules are, those rules are buried in hundreds of thousands of pages in the Federal Register. Moreover, the sub-regulatory underbelly is indicative of the massive non-delegation problem lurking in the modern administrative state. Rather than exercise the legislative power that the Constitution exclusively vests in Congress, Congress often punts the difficulty of lawmaking to the executive branch. Then the judiciary concedes away the judicial power that the Constitution vests in it by deferring to agencies' interpretations of a Congress's vague statutes or the agency's own vague regulation state. The result is that virtually all policymaking authority is shifted to the administrative state, and its actions are left largely unreviewed. While in the Tenth Circuit, Justice Neil Gorsuch said it much more eloquently than anyone else ever could. In his Lynch concurrence, he wrote, quote, "The fact is Chevron and Brand X permit executive bureaucracies to swallow huge amounts of core judicial and legislative power and concentrate federal power in a way that seems more than a little difficult to square with the Constitution of the framers' design. Maybe the time has come to face the behemoth." I knew quoting Gorsuch would make me sound like I grew up. So on behalf of him, thank you for applauding his words. Layer on top of that the Supreme Court's decision in Humphrey's Executor, which held that Congress can limit the president's authority to remove agency heads, and many of the most significant policy decisions and legal rules lie entirely in the hands of unelected and unaccountable agencies. Bureaucrats whose convenient claims of being nonpartisan are belied by quick reference to contribution history, voter registration records, and the like. Our modern regulatory system makes a mockery of the finely wrought system of checks and balances that our founders baked into our constitutional design. The framers separated government power, both between the branches and between the state and federal governments, in order to preserve liberty. When we tinker with the design, we tinker with our freedom. When we abandon the design altogether, we invite the sort of regulatory despotism that the Sacketts experienced and which Justice Gorsuch so eloquently criticized. Although the threats posed by the modern administrative state are perhaps unprecedented in American history, they are rooted in an intellectual struggle that has existed for a very long time. Whether one looks at the various competing schools of thought in Greek philosophy, the difference between the American and French revolutions, the theme is clear. More and more, you see basically two ways of viewing how we govern ourselves. One is where folks employ kind of so-called experts to make the big decisions, and others is more of a constitutional system where the people actually govern. Our founders knew this. They knew the corruptibility of man. Their deep skepticism of centralized power resulted in a constitutional system consciously decided to restrain, not enlarge, federal government's authority. In Federalist 51, Madison explained that the separation of powers safeguards liberty by setting ambition against ambition. If men were angels, he famously said, no government would be necessary. But because ours is a government administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. These founding principles were inverted during the expansion of the administrative state during the middle of the 20th century. And they have been mocked and abandoned by the modern statists who fashionably call themselves the progressive movement. Rather than seek to protect citizens from government, we have been told that the people can thrive only through government. Well-named agencies full of so-called independent experts have become the panacea for all social ills. That is the principle underlying the Supreme Court's decision in Humphrey's Executor, which held, contrary to the plain text of Article II, that the president's ability to control the actions of the executive branch must yield to the protections Congress has granted to the heads of so-called independent agencies. It is the principle underlying that notion that has had courts deferring to agencies' interpretations of the statutes and regulations they administer. And it's the basis for the Supreme Court's troubling decision in SEC versus Chenery from 1947, Chenery II, commonly called, which has empowered agencies to issue retroactive regulations through adjudication. A doctrine that has empowered agencies like the NLRB to announce new rules during enforcement actions without any fair notice to the parties being regulated. Justice Jackson saw the problem instantly, speaking in dissent in Chenery II. He said, it makes judicial review of administrative orders a hopeless formality for the litigant, even where granted to him by Congress. It reduces the judicial process in such cases to a mere feint. He succinctly said that the thinking of Chenery II would be in practice, would in practice put most administrative orders over and above the law. Compare Chenery 2 with Chenery 1, where the court said, but before transactions otherwise legal can be outlawed or denied their usual business consequences, they must fall under the ban of some standards of conduct prescribed by an agency of government authorized to prescribe such standards. I vote for Chenery 1, not Chenery 2. These fundamental shifts in our governmental structure are justified as necessary to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people. No doubt, we all want to be healthy, happy, and safe. But I submit that we can all be those things without abandoning the founding principles that make us free. So what can be done to change the regulatory culture? First, for starters, burdensome rules can be eliminated and regulatory costs can be reduced. One of the President's first executive orders was entitled Enforcing the Regulatory Reform Agenda, a rather straightforward title. Section 1 of the order very plainly declares it is the policy of the United States to alleviate unnecessary regulatory burdens placed on the American people. The order goes on to require each agency to designate a regulatory reform officer, or as some call them, RROs, because in Washington, D.C., we always need to speak in acronyms. Who will be? These folks are charged with carrying out the President's regulatory reform initiatives. So there's now a line of accountability between the agencies and the White House, consistent with Article II's declaration that the executive power shall be vested in the President. One of the President's other early executive orders was entitled Reducing Regulation and Controlling Regulatory Costs. It has two critical elements. First, for every significant regulation that an agency issues, it must identify two existing regulations for elimination. Not only does this discourage new regulation, but it forces agencies to clean out the regulatory sediment that has built up over decades. Second, agencies must control the regulatory costs their rules impose on the country by conducting economic analysis of their actions and offsetting any new costs with at least as much cost-saving deregulatory actions. The goal is not merely to maintain the status quo, but to drive down the costs imposed by previous administrations' regulatory excesses. And what about the judiciary? These efforts to reform the regulatory state begin with Congress and the executive branch, but they ultimately depend on courts that are willing to enforce the text of laws enacted by Congress and the structural limits imposed by our Constitution. This administration's mandate on judicial selection is crystal clear. Choose judges in the mold of Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and now Justice Gorsuch. Justice Scalia's impact cannot be overstated. He reminded us that the law consists solely of the words enacted by the people's representatives, whether in statutes, the Constitution, or a lawful regulation. Those words must be interpreted as they would have been understood by the public at the time of their enactment. There can be no secret meanings, no hidden agendas harbored in the minds of the lawmaker. In many ways, Justice Thomas's recent opinions are really the driving intellectual force behind so many of the Trump administration's legal and regulatory principles. In 2015, Justice Thomas issued an impressive set of concurrences and dissents, setting forth his view of the modern administrative state. They should be required reading for all law students. His concurring opinions in Perez versus Mortgage Bankers and Michigan versus EPA advance originalist critiques of Seminole Rock deference and Chevron deference as inconsistent with the separation of powers. Even Justice Stevens, the author of the Chevron decision, subsequently had critiqued it. This is not an issue that is particularly aligned with one party or the other, one school of thought or the other, rather. Justice Thomas's concurrences in the Amtrak case called for the non-delegation doctrine to be meaningfully enforced. Then the judicial acquiescence of Congress's unconstitutional transfer of legislative authority to the administrative state. And his lesser-known dissent in B&B Hardware versus Hargis Industries rejected the notion that decisions issued by administrative law tribunals could have preclusive effect on lawsuits filed in federal court. Even in this more arcane area, Justice Thomas's vision was clear. The Constitution vests the judicial power in the judiciary, not executive branch agencies. Regarding both Justices Scalia and Thomas, the interpretive principles articulated by Justice Scalia are the very bedrock of due process, fair notice, and the rule of law. And Justice Thomas's opinions demonstrate that those principles are missing in our current administrative state. In my view, the two issues are one and the same. Just as regulatory agencies should constrain their actions to the four corners of their statutory authority, judges must enforce those statutory limits. Just as agencies must provide due process to regulated parties like the Sacketts, judges must faithfully enforce the Constitution's structural protections, which exist to preserve individual liberty and personal property rights. And just as agencies owe the public fair notice of the rules, courts must interpret statutes and the Constitution as the public would understand them according to the plain meaning of the text. Due process, fair notice, originalism, and textualism. That's what this is all about. Justice Scalia's tragic death put these issues front and center in the 2016 election. In my lifetime, I cannot remember a presidential election that turned so critically on the role of judges. The president knew this, which is why he issued his list of candidates for the Supreme Court. He wanted the American people to know exactly the type of justice he would select. You may have missed it, but it came out recently. The president today announced he is actually refreshing his list of potential Supreme Court nominees, so it's public. And if I could just beg your indulgence for a second, for those of you who haven't heard it, I'll just we added five names to the list. Amy Coney Barrett, she was recently confirmed to the Seventh Circuit, and the dogma lives loudly in her. For the folks over there, in her confirmation hearing, that was the ranking member, Senator Feinstein, actually commented about now Judge Barrett, saying that the dogma lived loudly in her. So Judge Dogma is on the list. Britt Grant, who is a Supreme Court Justice in Georgia, is on the list. Brett Kavanaugh. He's winning on the applause meter. Kevin Newsom, recently confirmed to the 11th Circuit. And Patrick Wyrick, who is on the Supreme Court. I think I'm just going to throw in my notes and just go back to my opening. But I'm almost done with the boring part. So what do the judges on the list have in common? Well, they have a demonstrated commitment to originalism and textualism. They all have paper trails. They all are sitting judges. There's nothing unknown about them. What you see is what you get. It's not enough to say the right things in public speeches. Judges must apply those principles in concrete cases. Good judges follow the law, even when their decisions are unpopular. Judicial courage is as important as judicial independence. The president is looking for the same traits in lower court judges, especially with the Court of Appeals. Every pick matters. The president wants strong and smart judges who will apply the law as written. The interview process is something like the famed Scalia clerkship interview, except with folks from the White House counsel's office. We never ask candidates commitments about substantive issues, but they're pushed and prodded from every angle to get a sense of what method they would employ as a judge, how intellectually capable they are, and whether they possess the fortitude to enforce the rule of law without fear of public pressure. Of course, the president's power to nominate is only half the battle. So we've been actively engaging with the Senate since day one. I've spoken to or requested to speak to every single sitting senator. Not all want to speak to me. In many cases, more than once, about judicial appointments in their states. One thing that is missed from time to time by folks who just read the text of the Constitution is that the president gets to make nominations. They forget the part about the advice consent clause. The Senate, over many, many decades, has developed various customs that empower home state senators to have a big say, particularly in district courts. For those of you wondering why we just don't nominate you, the home state senators matter. And we take very seriously the obligation to consult with the Senate, and we painstakingly ensure that every senator has an opportunity to provide input on judicial nominees. First thing I tell each senator is we're happy to interview and will strongly consider anyone they recommend. Of course, some never take us up on this offer, and many tell us a different story to the press. But we are moving quickly to fill all existing judicial vacancies. Chairman Grassley and his team have done an outstanding job moving the president's nominees to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Candidly, Chairman Grassley does not get enough credit for his work on this. But the majority leader is really the one that has created this opportunity. The number of vacancies that were on the table when the president was sworn in was unprecedented. And the courage that Mitch McConnell showed to make that happen was tremendous, and we all owe him a credit gratitude. And not to be outdone, he has made this his number one priority, and he is delivering. The number of nominees that are being confirmed is tremendous. He is willing to burn the floor time to speak the Senate vernacular to get people confirmed. As most of us know, the Senate Democrats are insisting on the full debate on each nominee, even nominees who pass 98-0. District court nominees where both home state senators are in favor of the nominee and the like. Our opponents of judicial nominees frequently claim the president has outsourced his selection of judges. That is completely false. I've been a member of the Federalist Society since law school, still am. So frankly, it seems like it's been insourced. But seeking advice from Leonard Leo and many members of the Federalist Society is not outsourcing the judicial selection process. The fact is, we all share the same vision of the judicial role, and we welcome input from many sources. Many of us in this room became lawyers in the post-Bork era. I certainly did. We understand the importance of judicial selection, and we have seen firsthand the lengths to which others will go to tarnish the reputation of good men and women. I've already mentioned earlier this year the situation that confronted now Judge Barrett. Prominent Democrats suggested she couldn't be trusted because she's a practicing Catholic. Thankfully, she is now a judge on the Second Circuit. Greg Katz's hearing had the tone of the Spanish Inquisition merely because he had selflessly chosen to serve his country as an attorney during two Republican administrations. But he has been voted out of committee, and I'm confident he will soon be confirmed to the D.C. Circuit. I actually have to clap for that one. I want to thank Greg for his service. He's been invaluable to my work in the White House, it's really an honor to have been able to work with him and be a part of seeing him, Senate willing, go to the next level. Speaking of outsourcing, there's a different sort of outsourcing that is very real and should actually be troubling to all of us. During our efforts to consult with senators on potential nominees, we're often told that the senators have so-called commissions back in their home states that recommend judicial candidates to them. And these senators sometimes insist that they cannot support anyone on their commissions cannot support anyone their commissions do not interview and ultimately recommend. But I've never heard of the Judicial Commissions Clause in the Constitution. My Constitution says the President appoints judges with the advice and consent of the Senate, not a commission composed of plaintiffs' lawyers and others who have business before the very people that they will appear in front of. The problems with this practice are strikingly similar to the problems we face with the administrative state. See, no one elected the members of these commissions. They have no real accountability to Congress or to the President. Yet some senators want to delegate to them the power to select or reject candidates for lifetime appointments to the federal bench. And who are the typical members of these commissions? The very lawyers who will be practicing before the judges they have been tasked with selecting. That's the outsourcing problem, and it's very real. Then there's the American Bar Association. I told you I was going to come back to the good stuff. The ABA has no role whatsoever in President Trump's judicial selection process. Enough said. Despite these obstacles, we were very pleased with the quality and pace of our nominations. When the President took office, there were over 100 federal judicial vacancies, including the Supreme Court vacancy. In 10 months, the President has nominated over 70 judges to fill those vacancies. 14 of them have been confirmed. Nearly 50 are currently pending in the Senate. Dozens more are in the process and will be nominated shortly. Early next year, we expect a significant number of additional nominations. We know how important these appointments are to you and how important they are to the rule of law. We thank you for your support in this effort. In closing, this convention has rightly been a celebration of the Federalist Society's success. Not only did we celebrate the appointment of a committed originalist to the Supreme Court, but in the tradition of the Federalist Society, we have debated the most important legal questions facing our nation. How do we restore the rule of law, the separation of powers, and individual liberty in the face of the administrative behemoth? I want to thank the Federalist Society for the topic this year. The idea of a rigorous debate over the role of the administrative state could not be more timely. It's been beneficial to us in a personal moment. I feel that many of my harebrained ideas on administrative law are being debated here this week by very serious people. It's an honor to be a part of this, and it's an honor to have been a member of the Federalist Society for many, many years. Thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight, and thank you to everyone at the Federalist Society for making so much of this possible. Thank you.